Chapter 5, Joining a Fraternity. Interesting. The time had come for me to think about college. I'd been putting this off forever. All my friends had a plan. I was literally the only one who didn't have any idea what I was going to do after graduation. It wasn't like my mom had the time or the energy to sit me down and go, "Now, Davey, you need to study for those SATs so you can get into the Ivy Leagues." She was too busy working to pay the light bill. My brothers and I had to take matters into our own hands. So at the end of my senior year, I waltzed into the office of my guidance counselor, who I had not talked to in years, and said cockily, "I'm torn between Princeton or UC Santa Barbara. Help me pick. I mean, Princeton's great and UC Santa Barbara, I'm not sold totally on it, but tell me why I should go there." These were two schools I'd been thinking about back in 7th and 8th grade, back when I was killing it in every class and I was the king of the nerdlies. But at this point, I hadn't even thought about college since I saw Animal House freshman year. But I'm still fully confident that Princeton and Santa Barbara are on the table and waiting for my nod. The guidance counselor looks at me and says, "I'm checking out your grades. If I pull some strings, I might be able to get you into the community college across the street." Not the answer I was expecting. In my head, I'm thinking, "What the fuck, lady? I'm a genius. I'm not some dog shit community college guy. This'll kill my game." Not to mention, my mom would quietly cry because I had the one chance in the family to break out of the hood with a real school. Hood being the section of Scottsdale for people who made less than 150 grand a year. So I got to Scottsdale Community College. You knew it wasn't Princeton because our mascot was named the Artichokes. It would be funnier if I hadn't gone there. Everyone else had scrammed across the country and I was stuck driving 3 miles away to a college on an Indian reservation, for real. It was a little bleak for the kid who had read 47 books in sixth grade. The first thing I did as a college student was to sign myself up for early classes to make sure I didn't party too hard. 7:30 a.m. classes, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Done. If I was going to go to community college, I was going to be the best community college student ever. It's time to get serious again. Time to start a self-discipline plan. What a fucking mistake that was. Way too aggressive. I dropped that 7:30 class within 3 weeks. I was already worried less than a month in that my GPA wouldn't be as robust as I wanted it to be. I was smart enough to take tennis at night. I did pretty well in that, except I couldn't picture any future employers getting excited over that class. "Hey, I read on your resume that you get your first serves in a lot. Ooh, you're hired." None of my high school friends were around anymore, so this was a real wake-up call for me. You get spoiled in high school because there's always 10 people around to meet up with or have lunch with or hang out with. Suddenly, it's just crickets because everyone I knew who was with me at this crappy community college was not someone I wanted to hang out with. And I'm sure they were thinking the same thing about me. It's like the old Woody Allen joke. I never want to belong to a club that would have me as a member. Early in my first semester, I made a small blunder. Not to be confused with that old robot show, Small Wonder. I'd head back over to high school and sit on the wall by the cafeteria after my classes ended for the day. It didn't occur to me how desperate that was until one day a few seniors came over and started chatting me up. "Hey, dude, what's going on? Don't you have a class to go to in college?" I'm like, "Dude, I picked my own schedule, and I made sure I was tapped out by 11:30 in the a.m. It's perfect because I can come over here and have lunch with you guys and sit on the wall." The guy was like, "Remember how Perkins and Stiller used to come back and sit on the wall after they graduated, and we thought it was kind of a loser move?" I would chuckle, "Yeah, what a bunch of losers. Can't believe they did that. Get a grip, guys. Like, move on. High school's over." And then I just stared at the parking lot, oblivious to the fact that they were trying to tell me something. One night I was randomly looking through the local newspaper, the New Times, and I saw an ad for comedy night. I thought it might be cool to go watch because I was bored off my ass. Then I noticed they also hosted an amateur night. I sort of missed the old extravaganza days, so I thought maybe I could write down a little comedy act and give it a whirl. I went down and watched first. I checked out the amateurs a few days later, and they were horrible. I had the confidence that I could be just as horrible. So the next week, I got some balls and I went down and tried 5 minutes of material. I was 18 and terrified. I'd only seen comedians perform on Johnny Carson's show or cable specials, never in person. I didn't really know what a club comic actually did. First, I figured I could just go on stage and repeat jokes I'd seen Eddie Murphy or Billy Crystal do because I memorized their HBO specials. It never crossed my mind that would be considered stealing because this was so low rent. To me, it was just like being in a cover band singing the hits of Journey or Rolling Stones. I was simply paying homage. But I decided against this approach. I went down to that club with my crummy little scribblings. I definitely was the youngest guy who hit the stage that night. I looked about 11. Some of my killer jokes included, you know when you walk barefoot over someone's yard and it's made of gravel and rocks? And believe me, in Arizona, this is a real thing. There's very little grass around. It's all cactus and small, sharp rocks. Well, here's my impression of someone walking across that yard. And I'd walk daintily, lifting my hands in pain and go, ow, fuck, shit. Silence. Later, I changed the joke to, you know when you get a small rock in your shoe and every time you take a step, it moves to a different part of your foot? So people see you walking and you're like, ow, fuck, shit. Sort of the same joke, but better premise, I thought. You know when you squirt mustard on your liverwurst sandwich and the first 4 gallons are yellow water? I'm like, gross, where's the mustard? Good night, folks. It's a shame I wasn't discovered that night with such solid material. The club manager came up to me at the end of the night and said, yeah, your material was shitty, but what you said in between the jokes was funny. Do more of that. You can come back. This guy didn't realize it, but with one passing comment, he sort of summed it all up and really nailed it. The rest of my life, the best stuff for me would be those throwaway jokes. That's what would keep me alive in comedy. It took me a while to figure it out, and this dope nailed it in 4 minutes. I started hitting all the amateur nights in Scottsdale. Some would even slide you $20 gas money at the end of the night. I quickly did the math and thought, if I could get 4 paying gigs a week, I'd have $80 a week. It wasn't the toughest math problem because I used to be really good at math. Then I could quit my job, quit school, and become a pro comic full-time. In between amateur nights, I went to a club called Chuckles and saw my first actual professional headliner, a road club headliner named Barry Sobel. I could not believe how fucking funny he was. He was so fast, had such tight material. It's really big, broad comedy, which wouldn't be my style later on, but for then I was fucking dying. I knew that if I could ever pull together an hour of material that good, I would be on my way. Right now, that was beyond my comprehension. An hour of good shit. Too unreal. So maybe quitting school wasn't the best course of action at all. The following year, I got into ASU, Arizona State University. See you later, shitty community college. Let's stay friends. I had no money, a crappy car, a room in a bleak little apartment. I had a job at a clothing store where my brother Andy and his girlfriend Katie worked. Andy ran the men's side, Katie ran the women's. Later, they would start dating and create Kate Spade handbags and get rich and famous. Ah, that's another book, a better one. But for the time being, we all had these normal jobs and lives in Arizona. Getting into ASU was a huge upswing in my social life. Andy, my cool brother, was in a fraternity called SAE, Sigma Alpha Epsilon, Sleep and Eat. It was the preppy douche frat on most campuses, but at ASU was the coolest one. At least that's what I thought. They glommed onto me right away because I was Andy's little brother, and they asked me to join up. Oh, I was flattered. I went through rush week getting my ass kissed. I had a hunch this was too good to be true, and yet I still fell for this act. All week they were telling me that I was special and they'd be so honored to have me as a brother. Like a moron, I believed it. So I signed on to be a pledge. What a mistake. The second rush week is over. All the pledges were gathered into a room where the brothers began screaming at us, telling us what losers we were, and we were to address them as yes, sir, sir, active, sir, at all times, because we were pledges or plebes, and they were almighty active. I did this bullshit for 6 months. What a fucking moron. It was shocking at first the way they treated us, even though I should have known it was coming. I'd seen every fraternity movie, and they always treat the pledges like shit. I had been thinking these were the greatest guys I'd ever met. I got so bamboozled. Where were the cool guys that were kissing my ass? I sort of wanted to pull them aside and say, hey, I get the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde routine, but it's a little tired and frankly a bit corny. So let's maybe get back to that rush week attitude and why don't you fetch me a beer? All right, pal. These are the kind of comments that I was too scared to say to the actives, but I would whisper to my little pledge friends. Eventually, the whole fraternity found out I was sneaking off and doing comedy nights around town. This gave me a tiny bit of coolness factor, especially when we had mixers with the sororities. My favorites were the DGs, the dick grabbers, Gamma Phi Beta, Goofu Booze, Gamma Phi's, Grab a Thighs, and the Alpha Phi's, All for Freeze. They were all hot in my mind, and during rush week, I'd been told I could fuck any one of them if I just pointed at her. An active would bring her over to me. Of course, the story now was that none of the sisters would ever sleep with me because I was a loser pledge, and besides, I wasn't even allowed to talk to them. And P.S., go scrub the toilets, you plebe fuck fucker. So now my life consisted of four things. Working at the clothing company with Andy and Katie, doing shitty stand-up gigs at night whenever I could, being an SAE pledge and eating shit at every turn, and last, and what turned out to be the least, going to school. The pledging, or as they called us, being a funk, took up 90% of my time. I had to report in and do chores on the frat house every day. Chores, folks! Like I'm seven, do you get it? By the way, you were not supposed to call a frat house. You weren't even supposed to call it a frat. The actives got very angry. They would always yell, "It's a fraternity! Would you call your country a cunt?" That was their big line. It was sort of funny and logical, actually, but I still called it a frat all the time, but I don't call the country a cunt. Don't get me wrong. There were some pluses to being in the fraternity. It definitely forced you to make friends fast. And we were drunk most of the time. Plus, we went through so much shit together, it was like we were bonded for life. We were brothers, like vets from Vietnam. By the way, I wonder if people who were actually in Vietnam War get sick of this analogy. I use it all the time. I go to the bathroom in a gas station, I come out and go, "God damn, it's like Vietnam in there." I don't think a bunch of spoiled Scottsdale boys running around with their shirts off drunk, trying to fuck DGs, is an exact mirror image of seeing your three friends killed next to you in the real Vietnam War. But I'm going to keep using the analogy. Sorry. The downside of being a pledge was it sucked a lot of my time. My schoolwork was fading fast, my job was getting pissed at me for coming in drunk and or tired, and the comedy nights were tough because I had classes at night too, so I had to squeeze gigs in between. I pretty much felt like shit for 5 months straight. I didn't live in the frat house, so it was even worse for me because my older brothers would get drunk and call me in the middle of the night and go, "Come down to the house for a lineup or a work party." I don't like party used after the word work. In this context, you get to call it 4 a.m., and the work party was go fetch river rocks from the dried up salt riverbed and bring them to the house, or to come and do push-ups until they arrived. It was all such a mind fuck. But the biggest mind fuck of all was Oscar. We learned about Oscar on our first day as a pledge. Oscar was a pig, and he was the SAE mascot. We were informed that the worst pledge of the semester would be fucking Oscar the night we became active. Yes, you heard that right, folks. Fucking a pig. This was something I was positive had not come up during rush week. To get assigned the Oscar fucking duty, which felt like a fate that could befall any of us at any time, you had to be the worst pledge. This felt like a pretty easy task based on the feedback I had received so far. At 2 a.m, with beer being poured on my head, I'd be screamed at for what felt like hours. Funk number one, that's what they call me. Funk number one, you worthless piece of shit. You know you're going to get Oscar, you homo. You want to bone a guy pig. You want Oscar, you fag. You dream about Oscar. And I would sputter out a mouthful of Coors Light. "Yes, sir, sir, active, sir." "What? So you want to fuck Oscar?" No, I didn't understand the question. Funk number one wants to fuck Oscar. Then all the actives would make pig noises. This was like psychotic mind-fucking. It went on and on for hours. It's comical now, 20 years later, but we're in the front lines of Nam, and you're really in the pig shit, and you got paprika on your head and baby oil all over your body and spray-painted button on your chest that requires you to quote a certain line every time an active pushes it. All of this seems normal. By the way, my particular quote was, "Lordy, I'm so tired. How long can this go on?" To answer my own question, it went on for the full semester. Sometimes we served them dinner at night. We served them dinner, folks. Do you get it? The drunkest one would decide to get little spade on the little 2-foot-high fireplace and say, "Do your fucking jokes, comedian. Dance for us, you clown." And I would get up and do some sort of shitty act, and they would bitch they did the same lame shit last time they asked me. And I'd fire back, "Well, I'm not exactly on a yacht in the south of France writing new material. I'm usually in the shower trying to get paprika out of my pubes." But of course, I didn't say that. You might be asking yourself, where is my lovely, loving brother Andy during all this hellish process? Well, he wasn't exactly telling his brothers to go easy on me, his actual brother. In fact, he turned on me a few times when I was a plebe. One time I was in a lineup and all the pledges were drunk and beat up from doing push-ups and getting screamed at as the actives walked around casually sipping drinks and barking out orders. Andy, who was an active, walked by me and whispered, "How you holding up, bro?" And I go, "Not great." And he goes, "You want some ice cubes?" This was like fucking gold when you're dying. I go, "Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah." He casually turned and screamed to the entire room, "This pussy wants ice cubes. Funk number one thinks he's special. Everyone down and do push-ups. He thinks he's better than you." So everyone did push-ups while I sat there and ate ice cubes and felt their hatred. And I was like, these ice cubes are fucking awesome. The other time he burned me was the one in a million time in the mixer when I got to leave with the prettiest girl there. A 5'10" DG who was featured on the ASU calendar. They called her Wheels. For some reason, Wheels was flirting with me this particular evening, and I was freaking out about it. Maybe she just felt sorry for me. I thought this one might be my chance to get laid that semester as we headed back to her dorm. Her dorm was literally about 100 yards away, but being the gentleman I am, I piped in with, "I'll drive us, babe." Why did I want to show off my shitty car? I don't know. But we got my 72 Volvo and pulled out of the SAE parking lot shit-faced. I got pulled over within 5 seconds. And I don't even know why, probably a broken taillight. I gave the copper my ID, but he didn't even bother. Once he saw it, he just yanked me and cuffed me. I started begging. "This is my one chance with Wheels. I don't know why I'm going to jail. Please let me just slide this one time. Please, let me catch a break." Wheels waved to me and started walking home. I was like, "Wait for me." The cop told me I had a warrant for my arrest, which was news to me. And I went in and spent the night in jail, and a comic came and bailed me out. Turns out, Andy had a pile of speeding tickets, which he had signed my name whenever he got pulled over, because he didn't want to go to jail. When I called him on it, he didn't even give a fuck. Thanks, bro. I started to slowly realize that my only true chance of getting laid in my first semester at ASU was with Oscar. There was something great that came out of SAE Adventures. Every year there was a big show called Greek Sing. It was similar to Extravaganza, but bigger and better, and you had to be in a fraternity or sorority to participate. It basically involved big song and dance numbers, like from a play. But in between the acts, there were 10-minute breaks when a solo act would come out and sing or play the piano or do something else. I decided I need to be one of these acts. So I gathered up the kit that I'd put together for my comedy gigs, which consisted of a Tom Petty hat, a little blue suitcase, and a toy xylophone. For my Jeopardy theme bit, hilarious, my Casey Kasem impression, and the rest of my shenanigans, and I auditioned for it secretly. Yes, I was sort of a prop act at the beginning. I can't keep hiding this fact. Anyway, when I found out I made it in, I was ecstatic until the nerves kicked in. As the night got closer, I kept thinking, what the fuck am I doing? I was backstage listening to all the cheers for all the songs and these 3,000 people in the audience, and I almost couldn't take it. I felt super sick. Every pretty girl in the Greek system was in the room watching. Every guy who hazed me, every person that I would see at any party for the next 3 years was out there. And in the next 10 minutes, they were going to decide whether I was cool or not. When I found out no one had ever done stand-up at Greek Sing before in these little in-between acts, I nearly left the auditorium. I went in the bathroom to wipe the sweat off my face before I went on stage, and I made a deal with myself. I decided that if I went out there and bombed, I would quit comedy. My life was too hard at college as it was, and I couldn't take the physical toll of worrying about this shit anymore. If I bomb, I will stop. That was my deal. And it made me feel better, because in 10 minutes I was going to be able to quit, because I knew I was going to bomb. And then, out of nowhere, they introduced me. "From Sigma Alpha Epsilon, David Spade." They don't tell you what you're doing. They don't say, playing the piano, doing comedy. Nothing. I get a polite smattering. The applause stopped before I got to the microphone. Bad sign. I think I used the old, "How's everybody doing?" to get things rolling. I heard one guy go, "Bad. Strike one." Then I took the mic off the stand and I said, "Can you hear me?" I hadn't done a sound check, and I didn't realize that the crowd is absorbing most of the sound, so I couldn't hear them, and I couldn't hear my own voice. So that threw me, and then I heard, "No, we can't." Shit, I'm already off to a rocky start. Next, I mentioned something about going to the DMV, how much I hate it, and some people laughed, so I relaxed a little bit. Then I did my second joke, and more people laughed and realized I was doing stand-up, and the crowd decided to give me a chance. People stopped talking, my third joke killed, and I was off and running. I probably did 8 minutes that night, and they were the most memorable 8 minutes of my life, because that was when I decided I would do comedy forever. I got off stage and I was on cloud 12. I could not believe how excited I was. I felt exactly 180 degrees different of before I went on. It was fucking great. I did something right. From then on, everyone around town knew I was a comedian. People on campus started to come to my shows to see me. Guys walking by me at school would give me a head nod. That night was the single best thing I got out of the Greek system. I see people now on the street who have read that I was an SAE, and it's always funny because they like to stick their hand in from a crowd of people and slip me the secret handshake and give me a wink as if I'm going to let them and their 10 friends backstage. They think it's the handshake that separates them from the rest of the cattle. And it usually does, because I do give those guys a little extra time out of nostalgia. Some of those guys are really, really into being an SAE brother, and some are actually very cool. Everyone gets something different out of the Greek system, but it didn't really resonate with me. Because once I went active, they said, you made it through the hardest part. Now you get to do it to the next guys. And I thought, I don't want to do it to the next guys. It's too fucking mean. That was too tough mentally and physically to get through. And I had a job and school. I didn't have any money like the rest of them. So it wasn't just a party. I had to get something out of school. I had nothing to fall back on. And I didn't have a dad in the family biz to fall into once I graduated. I wouldn't do it to the next guys. I actually wound up dropping out of school after that and out of the Greek system. I went to do full-time comedy. I had some fun memories of my time there with the crew, but ultimately Greek sing was the thing that meant the most and changed the direction of my life more than college itself. So now, I'm a comedian. Chapter 6, or Seis in Spanish. Getting some heat. I'd been doing stand-up, kicking around the clubs for about 7 years, when I got my first and only appearance on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. I somehow snaked on 2 months before he retired. In my business, you hear a lot of stories about the lucky or the big break that launches someone's career, and those definitely do happen. But for me, the whole thing was a lot more gradual, and this helped keep me sane. I hated the pace of my career at the time because I'm super fucking impatient, but fast fame would be hard to handle. My slow, incremental rise to medium fame was easier to deal with mentally. I feel like the people who get famous really fast can't deal with the plethora, is that even a word, of shit that comes their way. You know, money and how everyone treats you differently in public, how your friends and family act towards you, etc., etc. I'm not sure people like the Kardashians would be more normal if they hadn't been on TV at a young age, but they couldn't be any more nuts, so I'm guessing fame did affect them. Also, if you are using a talent you have focused on your whole life, at least you feel like it paid off and you deserve the success in a tiny way, or at least some attention for your work. But when you're on a show where the talent is arguing in the kitchen with your family, I'm guessing you feel like, why the fuck am I a big deal? Because you have nothing to point to except selfies. Now, back to my story. We'll find out later why the Kardashians are annoying, but I think we already know that. Spoiler alert. I can't pinpoint the one break that made the most change for me. I'm sure most people would point to Saturday Night Live. That's obvious. But I wouldn't have gotten to Saturday Night Live without a lot of smaller things going right for me along the way, so each of those mini breaks was very important at the time. And at the time, each one of those things was the greatest thing that ever happened in my life, so they all seem huge. See what I'm saying? The first break I got was when I tried to get into the Los Angeles comedy club scene. This was after doing stand-up for about 2 years in Arizona. In Arizona, my big break had come when I got a slot in a bar called Anderson's Fifth Estate when I was only 19. They had a comedy night every Tuesday, and I eventually became a regular. My friends would often come out and see me. I also won third place in a comedy contest at ASU 1 year. I know, third place. Why am I bragging about it? I got a little whiff of micro fame after my bronze finish when I was packing up my Tom Petty hat and xylophone. A smoking hot ASU babe who was clearly out of my league was digging the fact that I placed in this half-assed contest. She came home with me and boned me for no apparent reason. I don't know if it was my UPS joke or my DMV bit that got her soaked, but I do know that the downside was this was also the first time I smelled a rank beaver. Don't crash your car. It was brutal. I won't elaborate, because I'm a gentleman, but it was like a bug bomb went off my room. It was super uncool. Naturally, I never mentioned it to her because I'm immature. And besides, there's really no way to break that news without devastating a woman. Hallmark hasn't really cracked the code on this subject. Believe me, I scoured the aisles at CVS for the perfect card to deliver the news. When school wrapped up that year, I decided to head to LA for the summer because I thought I might be ready for the comedy scene out there. My mom had gone to California to work for some multi-level marketing scam company. She was a writer for their magazine and got me a job there. The whole thing felt like a big scam to me, but I needed the dough. And plus, what do I care? So from 8 to 5, I spent my time filing stupid shit and plotting my comedy career. The only drug I could afford to numb my boredom was Dexatrim. For those of you under 40, Dexatrim was an over-the-counter medication marketed for weight loss. It was more like speed. Think of it as the Adderall for the 80s. Just so I could stay awake during boring filing. I know filing sounds glamorous, but it's actually shitty. Showbiz had to wait, at least from 8 to 5 p.m. I was aware of a few comedy clubs in town. The Improv and the Comedy Store were the most famous. There were some other places, but these were the biggest, the 7 nights a week places that I desperately wanted to crack into. They each had an amateur night, too, and I decided the Improv was my best shot. It's probably closer to my house. I drove down to the club one night with my crummy little shoebox of props. I decided that if I passed the audition, I could try to get maybe 2 or 3 spots a week, and then I could afford to move out to Los Angeles permanently. I put my stupid name in a stupid hat and waited. I sat in the back of the club in my dumb outfit. I had an old Batman sweatshirt, tight jeans, and Reebok high tops. The same thing like a girl would wear. Batman signals comedy, I guess. I don't know. The booker would pull 7 names at a time, and each time a name was called, my stomach would tighten up, and I would sweat a little more in a panic that I would get chosen next and have to go right on stage. I sat there like a dope, waiting from 8 to midnight, watching the crowd dissipate. I never got called. And then I had to leave because of the dog shit 8 a.m. filing job. My first trip to the Improv was a total bust. I realized pro showbiz would have to wait a little bit longer. I went back home to Arizona with my tail neatly placed between my legs, and I did stand-up in Arizona again. Then I hit the road for another few years to get better. That Improv disaster scared me off of L.A. for a bit. Then a comedian I had met named Fred Wolf got me a show at the San Diego Improv, opening for a comedy team called The Funny Boys with Jonathan Schmock and Jim Vallely. They were hilarious. Fred was a comedian who was very cool to me when he saw me go on in Arizona, so he helped me. He was a traveling road comic, and he threw me a bone because he liked my act. On a side note, we stayed friends. Later, he worked on SNL, and we wrote Dickie Roberts and Joe Dirt together. The Funny Boys were great. Super cool, super hilarious. They told me I needed to come back to LAASAP and audition at the Improv. They were talking in letters I didn't quite understand. I listened to them because they were a great comedy team. They'd also been on TV shows and had even worked as writers on some. Also, trivia alert, Jonathan famously played the maitre d' in Ferris Bueller. Jim even said I could crash on his couch for a while. My response? Fuck yes. I drove out west in my crummy red 72 Volvo a week later. I somehow ran into Louis Anderson soon after I arrived, and he told me he could get me auditioned at the Comedy Store. Louis was an even bigger deal. He was a regular at the Comedy Store and had been on Carson as well as many other shows. So I was sitting pretty in this go-round in the big city. I had 3 legit comedians vouching for me, and all I needed was one of these places to say yes. Either one would have been a major step for me in terms of becoming a pro comedian. Since there was such a rivalry between the clubs, you didn't get to play both unless you were a major pro. I wasn't gunning for anything like that. One would have been just great, thank you. So this time I headed to the Comedy Store, a hallowed place famous for launching the career of Richard Pryor and so many others before me. The woman in charge there is named Mitzi Shore, and she is notoriously tough. Plus, she's Pauly Shore's mom, but that's besides the point. Just trivia. I thought I had a tight 6 minutes to showcase for Mitzi. I wasn't as crazy nervous as I had been the time at the Improv a few years back. I finally ditched the props, thank God, and I was ready. Louis came up to me and told me that I was on in 20 minutes, so I hit the bar to have a drink and get my shit together in my head. Only now the stress was starting to get to me and my head started pounding. I threw back two Anacin tablets or something equally dated, maybe Bufferin, because I'm old. Now here's where it gets sort of interesting. The situation was so stupid, yet I remember every detail. I had only about an inch left in my Greyhound, which is vodka and grapefruit juice, and I tried to chase down my dry old school aspirins. Well, they didn't go down, and I choked, and then I ran to get water, and then I tried to hawk it up because one was now stuck in my throat. That didn't work either. Then somehow the aspirin reversed and moved its way into my sinuses, and it was burning away. I sniffed and hawked, which was a real treat for everyone. And after a few minutes, it came flying loose in a massive loogie. Hi, girls. So disgusting and such a project. Now I was exhausted. My heart was beating from the fear of dying, and my headache was 20 times worse. All of a sudden, I get called to stage. David Spade! I'm like, oh, shit. So for the first 5 minutes of my adult life, I hadn't been thinking about comedy. I was just trying not to die. Now I realize I lived through this fucked up sitch, but at the time I had to change gears very fast and go do the most important audition of my life. You can probably guess how this story ends. I did my dopey little act for Mitzi Shore before a modest crowd of about 40, and then scampered out in front on Sunset to wait. Louis came out a few minutes later. She's passing, sorry. Holy shit. What a horrible feeling in my gut. Could I be way off? Do I suck? I thought I did pretty good. No major fuck-ups. She liked your stage presence, but she doesn't think you're ready. Sorry. Silence. I just stare. Then I say, cool, yeah, okay. Yeah, well, thanks for setting it up. Sorry, it didn't work. Trying to sound undevastated. I drove home in a daze. Holy fuck. One of the key puppeteers of my career just said no. What the hell am I going to do now? Turns out I didn't have too long to figure it out. I had to go to the improv. This was my second and last hope. The Funny Boys had set up an audition, so this time around I didn't have to wait in line on amateur night with my props in a shoebox and my name in a hat. That meant I had to be ready to perform, because if they passed on me, I couldn't audition again for another 6 months. And when I did, I would already have a stink on me from getting passed over. I was staying on Jim Valley's couch, and every night I was quietly freaking out as my audition crept closer. I am overthinking my act completely, and I really couldn't practice because no one will put me on stage. So I said it out loud in the bathroom, in the mirror, and I can safely say I was not killing. The night of my audition, we all headed down to the club. I was 20 years old, not quite 21. I looked 15. The chalkboard outside the club included the name of the evening's performers, and for the first time, my name was on the chalkboard. I'd gone there so many times to hang out and snoop around, have a drink, try to catch a glimpse of the great comedians I'd seen on TV, people like Jay Leno, Paul Reiser, Jerry Seinfeld, Kevin Nealon, Dennis Miller. They were all in the lineup. They all seemed to me about 35, which was the oldest age I could think of at that time. I thought my only chance was that I was 20 with long white blonde hair, and a lot of my jokes were about looking young. That would set me apart because Reiser, Seinfeld, Leno all had sort of a similar comedian look in my eyes. So I tried to use my different Arizona look to help me stand out. I think that night I opened up with, "Hi, I'm David Spade, and I'm 10. That would usually get a laugh. And then I held up 10 fingers and go, "That's this many." Smaller laugh. My mom just dropped me off. She's at Safeway. She'll be back to pick me up at 9. That usually went well. My set did pretty good. I went back to the bar super adrenalized because I thought I had a chance at getting a weekly spot there. We sat at a big table, and then one of the Funny Boys got word that I passed, and I got to be a regular. So he ordered a round of shots. Bruce Willis, of all people, happened to be there that night and knew the guys, so they invited him to join us. I was shitting my pants then because I was sitting next to Bruce Willis. I almost forgot about making the improv until a waiter came back with the shots. He handed us all a shot and said, "Wait, I need to see this dude's ID." That was the biggest needle scratch moment. Obviously, I didn't have it with me. I mean, I did, but it said I was 20, so it doesn't help to show him. I did the old, "I think it's in the car." So in a major buzzkill move, he took the shot back. All the fun was sucked out of the moment, and a heap of embarrassment packed on top. But on the bright side, I was going to be getting regular spots at the improv now. Then it hit me. I'm going to have to move to Los Angeles. This shit's about to get real. I flew home and told my mom. She had moved back to Scottsdale after the LA job wrapped up. She was happy for me, but scared about things like where I was going to live, how I was going to eat, you know, important issues that didn't cross my mind. But the window was open for me, and I had to go for it. And in a stupid move, I sold my car for the money that I would need to get started in L.A. And in a stupider move, I sold it to my brother Brian, who said he would send me the cash but never did. And in the stupidest move, I am now in L.A. without money or a car. All I have is 2 20-minute spots at the Improv for $35 a pop. Jim Valley told me I could stay on his couch again, and thank God he did. He also had an old girlfriend who rented me a car for $80 a week. I was already $10 over budget. The car was an old light blue Dodge Dart with 3 on the tree, which means it was a stick shift, but the stick shift was on the steering column, so it was very hard to drive. I knew how to do it from my old valet days. It had a crack in the windshield, the works. But I loved it. I ran out of money pretty much in a week. Jim told me I could have the change he kept in a jar, so I took it down to Ralph's for a rotisserie chicken. I went home and doused it in my favorite A1 steak sauce. Yummy! The Improv would let you eat there on nights when you had gigs, but you had to sign for your meals, which meant that when check day came around, I'd be looking at a grand total of $5. It was lean stuff, very survival mode, very Bear Grylls, but I was getting spots on stage, and that's all that really mattered. After I spent another weekend on his couch, Jim had had enough of me, and he told me he had a friend going to England that would sublet me her studio down on Stanley and Santa Monica Boulevard. This, I found out later, and I was literally the official last one to find out, was a very gay neighborhood. Being from Arizona, I would parade down to 7-Eleven and back with no shirt and Quicksilver shorts. Every day, all day. Like a little Joe Dirt in training. A lot of wolf whistles that I certainly never picked up on. But my most memorable night in that studio was spent lying in the futon on the floor. It was sort of no frills at this place. And listening to a woman scream bloody murder next door. I didn't know if they were having sex or if he was killing her. I've never heard girls get loud during sex. Whenever I look down at them, they just say, "Continue." So I didn't know what was going on. I lay down there, missing Arizona, and all my friends hang out at my mom's house. All I could think was, what if something happens to me? I don't even know where a hospital is. I don't know anyone. I don't have health insurance. Such a pussy. Then the screaming escalated, not mine. I was terrified. I picked up the phone to call 911, but I couldn't do it because I thought they would know it was me and they would come kill me. So I got a huge knife from the kitchen. I sat on the bed facing the door and holding the knife. I was ready to kill whoever came in. I was also scared shitless. The sun came up around 7:30 the next day and I woke up. I had fallen asleep on my side with my face on the knife. All that drama, and I could have died by stabbing myself in the fucking face while I was sleeping. Who knows if she lived or died, that girl. It actually never crossed my mind again. One day, after a few sets at the Improv, they got a call from a casting director that was doing Police Academy 4, the good one. They were looking for a wise-cracking skateboard kid, and they had been in the audience a week before and seen me perform. This was the best thing about the Improv. There was always someone in the crowd who could help you. A director, a casting director, an actor, famous comedian, studio executive, or just a friend of any of those people who would tell them about you. So I went in for the audition, and the casting director told me there was no script. Those of you who have seen the movie can surely believe that this is true. My character was a new addition, and they were actually waiting for a new draft of the script, but thank God they didn't have one, because I haven't mentioned this yet, but I have no idea how to fucking act. I'd never had a class. I never read a book about it. I thought it was overrated. I sort of figured myself to be some kind of natural like Eddie Murphy. They put me in front of a camera and told me to say things about skateboarding that I might say to a cop and use skateboarding terms and just make up stuff. This was music to my ears. I'm pretty good on my feet at improvising and I'd been skateboarding for 10 years. So I talked about how I hurt myself during an aerial axle stall and fell from the coping to the drain, broke my wrist, did some grinders. I threw in some jokes, Bertelman, this, that, kickflip. They asked a lot of questions, but thank God none of the questions were, "Do you know how the fuck to act, dude?" Since I promise you I never would have gotten that part if I had to answer that. Reading the audition off a script, I found out later, was unbelievably hard. We'll get to that later. So I ship off to Toronto in shock that I have a role in a movie series I've actually heard of starring the Goot, Steve Guttenberg. I get to my hotel, and only two of us from the cast are at this particular hotel, me and none other than Sharon Stone. Sharon was drop-dead gorgeous, as she is today, and a total sweetheart to me. She wasn't a huge star yet, obviously, or she would not have been anywhere near this movie. I quietly stared at her night and day throughout the shooting because she's so goddamn fucking gorgeous, which was one very nice perk of working on the movie. Money was also a nice perk. I made $2,500 a week for 10 weeks. Run of the picture, as they call it. I was flying high. I got to do my own skateboarding and show off for all the ladies on the set, which was a blast. I had to have a stunt double for the hard skateboarding stuff, so they brought in pro boarders from the Bones Brigade on the West Coast. Chris Miller and Tony Hawk. Chris was closer to my size and look, but rode regular foot. Tony was 2 feet taller than me, but rode goofy foot, and I rode goofy foot, so he made more sense. Goofy foot is a term to describe which way your feet go on the skateboard. When you face forward on the board, my toes point to the left, and when you're regular foot, you point to the right. That's a fact you'll never need again in your life. Back to the cash. I'd never made this much money before, so I actually felt rich. I remember walking down Toronto's main street, and I had $300 on me. I was looking in a window. Inside, I see pants that were $60, which is a lot. And I thought, I could just go in there and buy those pants. They would never think I had this much money. It was like Pretty Woman, except they probably would have treated me like more of a whore. The movies ended, and I flew back to Los Angeles with $10,000 cash on me, like a regular Floyd Mayweather. I considered stopping at a strip club and making it rain / downpour. You know, I could have pulled a Chris Brown and really had fun for an hour and a half. But no, I decided I was going to be smart about this. I gave my mom $3,000. God knows I owed her that and more. Paid about $1,000 for my own bills. And then I had $6,000 left to buy a car. Now, buying a car is fun. I had never had anywhere near $6,000 to plunk down on wheels. This much money was enough to get me a car better than my last two cars put together, which had cost me $300 and $1,000 respectively. So I poured through Auto Trader, yeah, Joe Dirt. Like Joe Dirt looking for a Hemi. I only put that in Joe Dirt because I used to always look at Auto Trader. Check this out. Dash mats for $80? Are you kidding me? I started to get weak hanging onto the Camaro page for too long. I was dog-earing cars that I should not have been looking at. I needed a basic, reliable, gas-efficient, boring car, not some tricked-out muscle car. So, going against my urge to buy a sweet pussy wagon like Grease Lightning, I decided on a boring, dark gray two-door Honda Accord hatchback. It had good gas mileage, and that's about it. I did spring for the sunroof to make it a bit more of a pimp sled. And it was exactly $6,000. Called some woman, met her down at Factor's Deli on Pico. I walked around the car, tire kicked a little bit like I knew what I was doing. Had her pop the hood. Engine was in there, check. We're all good. On the right track. Then I bust out an envelope with 60 crisp $100 bills. Forked it over, shook hands and left. I was now the proud owner of a Honda. I headed off to the improv high as a kite with a new car I just bought with money from a movie I just made. Now I had a spot at the world-famous improv. I had the L.A. thing down. After my set, I invited Tim Rose, who had also been on that night, to come out and check out my badass car. Like he would be so amazed to see an 83 Accord. But he was cool. As we were walking down the street, Tim started to get antsy because we'd been strolling for 4 or 5 minutes and no car. Then it dawned on me that my car was gone. It had been towed. Holy crap. I did the walk of shame back to the improv and got on the payphone. Yes, folks, a payphone. I know they are gross. In fact, I think that's how I got crabs 5 times in high school. Anyway, the tow yard then informed me my car was not there. Holy fuck, it got stolen. I turned white. I'm already white. I got whiter. I'd had this goddamn car for not even an hour, and now it was gone. I had no insurance. I never even put it in reverse. I just sat there staring into space thinking, I just shot a movie for 10 fucking weeks and I'm exactly where I was the day before I left. I have no money and no car. I was embarrassed and I was pissed off. I slinked off into the night, sadly walking all the way back to my shitty futon in my shitty sublet apartment in the gay neighborhood that I didn't know was gay. A few tears might have been squeaked out along the way. I know all of you think of me as a tough guy, a hard ass, an athlete in movies and TV, but this one got to me, folks. As if this town weren't hard enough, it took my car just to bitch slap me for having a few minutes when I felt things were going the right way. I had never gotten so much nothing for $6,000. I would have been better off running on the 405 freeway at noon, naked, throwing all $6,000 bills in the air. At least I would have gotten some press out of it. Chapter 7, Losing My Heat That I Just Got. So what next? I was still broke, running low on Top Ramen. With my pride empty, if that's a term, I went to see Bobcat Goldthwait. He was always nice to me, and now I was there to abuse the friendship. I couldn't ask the funny boys for more. They had already done enough. It was Bob's turn to take on the burden of Spade. Side note, there was this guy, Tim Rose, who I mentioned earlier, one of my buddies from Arizona. He has a rich older brother. And right after I started doing stand-up in Arizona, I made Tim's brother this offer, even though I didn't know him that well. I told him that if he would cover a tiny apartment in L.A. and buy me a crappy car, he could have 15% of whatever I made for my whole life. I said I'd sign whatever he wanted. He didn't take me up on this unbelievable deal. But he did call me about 4 years ago and say he thought it over, and he'd like to roll the dice with me now and ask me what kind of shitty car I wanted. By the way, most of you already know this, but it's very, very embarrassing to ask friends for money, even if it's legit, and I've done it a lot. That's why when people do it to me now, I try to make it easier for them because I know how horrifying it is. I usually just say strip first or whatever. Dana Carvey once told me that he gets nickel and dime so much by acquaintances and so-called friends that sometimes it's worth the $800 just to never talk to them again. Because if they aren't a close friend, you know for sure they're not paying you back, so they avoid you forever once you give them the cash. So it sounds harsh, but for some shady people, it's a good idea. You don't do that to family and good friends, but sometimes people just have the balls to ask you. Chris Rock also told me that when I started to get money, be careful because most people highball you. He always says he gives half the amount they ask for because he knows they pad it with extra shit, like a new surfboard or some drug money. So if they ask for $10,000, he gives them $5,000. It's not a bad system. But I usually give full freight because I feel too condescending asking what they really need it for. It's not my business. Chris also says, you ever lend people money and they have the balls to buy shit in front of you? Dude, don't you owe me $800 and you're buying a coat? Chris is funny and I like him better now that I can use his jokes in my book and the laugh sort of counts on my stats. Sweet. Anyway, now it's back to square one. But I had a movie under my belt, which was great. That gave me some heat, as they say in the biz, which is what you need to jumpstart things. So right before I left, I signed with a respected agent. I'd gotten a manager, Mark Gervitz, who worked at Brillstein right before I got the movie. He had seen me at the Improv. So they made my Police Academy deal, and now aside from my screw-up with the stolen car, I was back on track. I wound up borrowing another $6,000 from Bobcat. This was very tough to go in for a reload, but he said he wasn't worried because I would work a lot. He's a very nice guy, and that was very cool of him. I signed a note saying I'd give it back in a year. It seemed feasible. So now I went to buy another car so I could hit the audition world. But what do I get? Dark gray 83 Honda Accord, the exact same car. But this time four-door, which I like better. Weird how I found almost the exact same car, but this time I insured it first. By the way, I told the police the woman who sold it to me originally probably had someone follow me with a duplicate key and just stole it back. He agreed and then proceeded to not give a shit and do nothing about it. So now I had a car and I was staying at that studio apartment and ready to party. My manager then informed me that my agent had left a big agency, no names, lawsuit alert, I already took it out, and gone off on her own. So I'm like, what the fuck? I liked her. What do I do? He said the big agency still wanted me and we should stay there. So they assigned me another agent. Now this is a tough predicament because it wasn't someone who had gone out, loved me, and fought to get me. This is a person saying, sure, I'll look after them in case they hit it big. But the agent had no real stake in my career, and they might have even thought that I sucked, but still, I thought I was in great hands. Because it was what? A big agency. Our first call was to Steve Holland, a director Bobcat introduced me to up in Toronto, who had me read parts of his script to him as sort of an impromptu audition up there. He said he was still interested in me for the lead in a new Fox pilot called Beans Baxter. I guess that's what I read scenes from, but I'm so fucking dumb, I didn't even get what I was doing. Fox was still sort of a newer network and didn't have tons of respect at the time. But we all know it turned out to be a monster. So because I have a good agency and a manager and a little heat, they somehow get this guy to offer me the part without ever going back into audition again. All he was going off of was me stumbling through a cold reading during Police Academy. This is a miracle. I'd never really acted, still never taken a class. I just got lucky. Because I got a good response my month or two at the Improv in a movie, people thought I was about to blow up and they needed to jump on it. So guess what? We turned down the part. This was crazy to me. I hadn't gone on one audition and they wanted to turn down a straight up offer. I always wanted to be on a half hour comedy. This seemed like a perfect fit. It was about an FBI agent who's undercover as a high school kid or something. I loved it. I went into the big agency and all these agents came together in one room to meet me. I think you're too good for this. Fox isn't big enough. You have heat. We are setting you up to meet NBC, ABC, and CBS. That's where you should be. This is what they told me. I'm like, well, I haven't really done jack shit. I mean, isn't this huge? My own fucking show? I can't picture why I would say no. I don't get it. Trust us. You're going to get a show on one of the big three. So I trusted him. I went against all gut feeling and said, I guess you guys know what you're doing. I'm new to this. I also fell victim to believing the hype. Now I had to go on meetings with all the networks because pilot season was hitting. So here I was, the guy in the 83 Accord, bopping around to audition for every show in town. And being horrible at it. I had no idea how to act. Literally. I would just stare at pages, always sitting, read stage directions out loud, fucking characters' names out loud. I don't know what was going on. Such a goddamn rookie. But I didn't care because I knew they would see through all this bumbling and hire me because I'm a natural and I had heat. Over 2 months, I had about 30 auditions and I got the same feedback every time. He sucks. He's too green. That's a way of saying I'm shitty at auditioning. I have no experience and no amount of heat or hype was going to get me hired. I basically burned every bridge to every casting agent and network exec in town. I came out on the other side of that pilot season with nothing but a bad rep and no show. The only thing I got was reading in Variety that Beans Baxter was a great pilot and Fox was going to make it a series. Without me, I couldn't have felt sicker. What a huge fuck up. I had exactly what I wanted and got talked out of it. I made a vow to always stick with my gut feeling and speak my mind. I swore this would never happen again. It's happened about 500,000 times since then, but I'm a pussy, so what do you want? My manager, Mark, now had a game plan to shake shit up. He knew I was on the ropes and about to jump off a ledge. He told me I should leave the big agency. Fuck them. They hadn't helped me enough, and they gave me bad advice. He knew a mid-level agent somewhere else who is great and thinks I'm hilarious and would love to represent me. So with my head spinning, knowing I had turned down a great job, and that the whole town knew I was a fraud, I agreed. Plus, more bad news, all my precious heat was officially gone. I was in worse shape than when I got to town. This was crushing me. I went from 0 to 100, back to 0. Frozen. Now I signed up for acting class, way late. It was finally time. I was back to square one, but at least I had an agent that liked me and a great manager. So these classes were crucial. Every casting director I met with would not see me again because I was so bad. So I had to get some classes under my belt and try to get back in to see them again and change their mind. This was quite a job. So I signed up with the great Roy London, but his class was overflowing, so I take his protege, Ivana Chubbuck. Now, she was a blast, a bit kooky, but very good. I took the class 2 times a week, and I would do stand-up in town or on the road the other times. I was getting serious about this shit. I couldn't float by on my charm and my natural ability. By the way, class was way harder than I thought, too. My buddy Rob Schneider, who I met during stand-up, took him with me. So did Julie Warner, who wound up being in Tommy Boy later. We all had fun in class, and it was like school. Lots of meeting with flaky scene partners and getting props and studying lines, blah, blah, blah. You would do about 1 scene a week, and you had to be ready, because if not, you would be ripped apart in front of the whole class. Even worse, half the class consisted of babes who had just moved to L.A. to act. So when you were bad, they were like, I might have fucked this guy, but now it's confirmed by the teacher that he's a talentless piece of shit. I'll just go nail piven. But even with all these ups and downs, I have to say these classes really helped me. They gave me a better understanding of how to break down a scene, how to audition, and a million other intangibles. And definitely confidence. Every few days, the improv would have some important person in the crowd. It was a gift to go on stage there. Auditions were basically coming to you. On top of that, they had a lot of showcases. That's when a casting agent or director wanted to see a bunch of comedians for a specific show or movie part. One night, the guy who books Johnny Carson would be in. A week later, Star Search guy. A day later, someone looking for a funny friend of the lead actor in a movie, etc. But to get on those showcases was very hard. You had to beg and call and hang around and hope someone saw you and called you to put you on the list of people they wanted to see. I weaseled on a few of these, and one day got a call from a scout for the Joan Rivers show. He said they wanted to book me as a stand-up. Wow. Now, when Joan started, this was a huge deal. She turned her back on Carson, as the story goes, and she was competing against him now in late night. I was miles away from getting on Carson, but this was somewhat in my vicinity. My manager told me one day that I got the booking. As I was shitting and celebrating, he said, "Oh, by the way, Star Search wants you too, but we can't do both, because there's a conflict." I was like, "Okay, cool, cool." I said that very quickly, but down deep, I was wondering if I'd rather do Star Search. I had auditioned for Star Search in Arizona at a mall 2 years earlier and never got a call back. So embarrassing. Sweaty and standing near a fountain below Chess King, ripping through my 2 minutes aloud. But being new in a small town, you'll do whatever. It was like in later years having American Idol come to town. When you don't have the money to travel, this is the thing you have to try. So I tried and whiffed. But now I get to turn them down. Yeah, huge victory. Or shoulder shrugger. Turns out they survived without me. Answer was shoulder shrugger. Now I finally got to do my first TV stand-up. And it was on Joan Rivers' newish talk show. I was, of course, scared shitless. I had my Guess, which is a brand, Guess brown button-down shirt with pearl buttons all laid out. This was the shirt I looked good in. I had no confirmation on this, but I was going by a hunch, my mirror. I got a call right before that there was going to be a guest host that week. Joan was taking a vacation. She was probably aware that the show was tanking and her vacation was meetings to plot her next move. I was told that, of course, I would still go on. I really had no say in the matter. And I was happy to find out the guest host would be a comedian I'd heard of named Arsenio Hall. So I prepped my set and brought my roommate down and pretty much crushed it, I have to say. Bits went well, but one thing that stuck with me was I sort of blacked out in the middle, or should I say blanked out. One word in my act didn't come to me right away, and I quickly replaced it with a similar word, but that really got to me. It probably wasn't noticeable, but to me, it was a huge fuck-up. I had done these bits literally hundreds of times. How in the fuck could I blank out? I have to chalk it up to the nerves of playing on live TV. When you see a comedian on TV, which I'd seen a lot, he's standing in front of a curtain looking great in a suit in front of a polite crowd. And that's what I was used to. But when you perform on a show, it's totally different. You walk out and you see the flip side. Brighter lights than I'd ever been in, like police interrogation. That's the first thing I wasn't ready for. Then the crowd. All I could think was, wow, it's smaller in here than it seems on TV. And they are so far away. Oh, look, that guy has a Hawaiian shirt. Oh, he's wearing shorts inside. These were my thoughts, folks, not my act. And there were four cameras with chubby, bored cameramen behind me. I wonder how much that guy makes. This was in my brain instead of my jokes. Do you get it? This is what's called being spooked. It's like a horse. It wasn't what I was used to, and I had to get my brain back on track in my 5 second walk to my mark, which was a black X on the ground. Wow, the stage is so shiny and polished. More shit unfocusing me. Do your goddamn act, Spade. Luckily, the show got a good reaction. My manager and agent were getting calls again. Nothing like before, but a few curiosity calls. Fine. This was good because I'd been trying to de-thaw for months, trying to get a smithereen of heat again. 2 weeks later, I was in Salt Lake City playing cartoons. Most clubs have dumb names. And I got a call from my manager. They wanted me back on Joan, but not to do stand-up. To guest host, folks. What the fuck? I didn't get it. I'd never done a TV show before. That was my first one. How would I be able to host? Are you joking? But there was trouble at Joan's show, and they were sort of auditioning people to take over. I really didn't understand all that, but I was floored that they thought I could handle it and be good at it. I just turned 23 that week. I ultimately passed on hosting for a night, which shocked everyone. I just felt like I did my best set a week before, and if I did anything less or looked nervous, I'd be dismissed and thrown in the scrap heap. And that could possibly erase any potential heat I had without thinking it through. So I passed, mostly out of fear. This perked up the ears at Fox. They called me in for a meeting. I got to sit down with Garth Ancier and Barry Diller. Barry was the big boss and Garth was the new president. It went well. They said they were curious as to why I would turn down something so big early in my career. I said I didn't want to fuck it up. I wasn't ready for it yet. And I ultimately wanted to be on a sitcom. They respected that and they said they would keep an eye out for me. And now I was finally starting to inch back into the town's good graces. Every year, HBO had a showcase to look for comics to appear on their annual Young Comedian special. Getting onto that show was a huge deal for me, and a huge deal in general. This was the show that broke Sam Kinison, among many others. A slot on that show meant millions of people would know who you were. Landing the HBO Young Comedian special would be just the right thing to get me hot again. Ooh. Hot is a gross term used in Hollywood, and I never say it, but it seems to make sense, so I'm using it. Hot. Gross. Sickening that I even say it. Even getting on the HBO showcase at the Improv was very hard, but I squeaked through. The first year I didn't make it from the showcase onto the special, and that killed me. They said I was good, but I wasn't ready, whatever. I was pissed because now I had to wait another full year to try out again, and there wasn't many TV shows back then. So you had to dive on one. I went back to the club scene taking small television and movie scraps whenever I could get them. It's so funny how you look back and you see what could have been. During this time, I got very close on two very different shows, In the Heat of the Night and Full House. For Full House, I had several callbacks for Joey's part, the role that eventually went to Dave Coulier. I remember the audition had some bit about socks in the basket. I had that fucker memorized. But in the end, I didn't get the part, and I was so crushed because I felt I was letting everyone down, especially my mom, because back home, there's a lot of mumbling and grumbling about my career not taking off, and it was tough. It was tough for me to hear, and it was tough for my mom to listen to. The stress was killing me. I was getting vertigo, which is probably from grinding my teeth, which is from this town, killing me. It happens to almost everyone. You think you can handle it, and you're ready for anything, like the parking tickets, the traffic, the no friends, but there's intangibles that get to you. The way people dismiss you when you do a bad audition, the time it takes for your agent to call you back, it's sort of a slow death. And I sound dramatic, and that's only because I'm a pussy. On a cheerier note, I had a great audition for In the Heat of the Night, which was surprising to everyone because this was a drama. This was serious. I had to play a Southern Police deputy opposite Carol O'Connor, who was a mega TV star. For some reason, I nailed it. I was so happy. I got a callback, then another one, then another one. I was this close to getting this part, only to lose it at the last minute. Looking back, I realized everything happened for a reason, but you could not tell me that then. I kept getting crushed by these close calls, but I would have been on either of these shows for 7 years, and my whole life would have been different. If I had landed In the Heat of the Night, I would have been stuck in sweaty New Orleans for 7 years with my nuts glued to my leg and no time for comedy. Back then, I just had tunnel vision to get a gig. Now I think of how lucky I am that neither of these happened to me. So another half-assed year went by, and here comes the HBO Young Comedian special again. And I whiff. They pass me again. But for some reason, the slots go to established comics at the time, like Richard Belzer. What the fuck, HBO? I'm actually a young comedian, folks. This was another near-death blow. So I tucked my tail between my legs where it felt most comfortable, and I headed back to bit parts on Alf and Baywatch. One of those was more fun than the other. You decide. I also head back on the road, which by this point had become my life. Dallas, Cleveland, San Diego, New York. Some were great, some truly sucked. But New York was by far the toughest. I had a buddy who was attending Columbia back then. So when I wanted to work the New York comedy circuit, I use quotes here around wanted because I didn't want to take these trips at all, as you will see. This comedy circuit was more like a trip to the hole. Jail term. I had to call my friend and ask if I could crash there. I also had to call this dude Gary Grant, who was like a booking agent. I don't even think I ever met him. Maybe I did. But he was tapped into tons of random comedy gigs around New York and Jersey. Most of the gigs were just stupid one-nighters for $75 a pop. Once I called Gary, the production began. I had to fly to New York, which was expensive. Then I would stay with my buddy at Columbia. The only place he had room for me to sleep was sideways on a love seat with my feet on an ottoman. Great for the bad neck, folks. There's a reason you don't see this position in a mattress commercial. I did this for a month, and I was creaky and stiff as hell. But if I had to pay for a room, the paltry earnings I received from gigging would have disappeared. When I did have a show, this was the basic drill. I would suit up in my lame New York coat. Being from Arizona, I really didn't have a heavy coat, so I bought a wool herringbone coat from a thrift store. It was referred to from then on as my New York coat. And yes, it looked stupid on me. Then I dragged my mom's small honeymoon suitcase of props down to the subway. This was a feminine light blue suitcase for my mom's honeymoon with her initials on it. It was sort of a please mug me and or rape me look. If anyone's curious about the contents of my light blue prop suitcase, one of the props is a small toy xylophone that I still had from my killer Jeopardy bit, which was super reliable and a possible closer, very solid bit. I also had a cardboard thing for a dynamite Wheel of Fortune bit, mixed results. And most cringy, I carried my Tom Petty hat, which I stole off a valet parker at a New Orleans hotel for my big Tom Petty impression. It was all so embarrassing. I would take the subway in the cold down to 42nd Street, walk another half mile to the improv, wait for some New York comedian with a car he was going to drive us to a gig outside the city. These one-nighters were between 30 minutes and 2 hours away. The guy who took me the first night I did all this was 36 years old. I remember thinking, holy shit, this guy's old. If I'm still doing this crummy job at 36, please blow my brains out, because that's inching up on me. Once one of these dog shit gigs was 8 hours away in Watertown, New York. This meant I had to stay overnight. I clearly wanted to be a comedian so badly that I was willing to drive with a total stranger for 8 hours in his Nova to a tiny town, making shitty small talk for a shitty show to stay in a shitty hotel, to shove off again the next morning and do it again, 8 hours home. It was life on a hamster wheel, but it was what you had to do. By the way, there were no apps to see if this guy was a registered sex offender. This was the Old West, sort of, in the East. I would love to have that app because it would be so funny and embarrassing to have it go, sex offender, 2 feet to your left. I'd be like, I guess that's you. And then we'd laugh and then he'd rape me. And then we'd stop and eat at Subway. Hey, Jared, I think you know this guy. One time when I got back to the improv after one of these trips, two comics there asked me if I wanted to go smoke crack with them. I politely declined. Then they said, you got $75 tonight. What are you going to do with it? I said, blow $8 on a cab to go to my friend's place, use some for food maybe, and save a bit. They laughed, and one of them said, mostly to his buddy, if I ever wake up the day after a gig and there's money in my pocket, I know I did something wrong. They both cracked up at this. I'm not sure why I remember that exchange so vividly, but it stuck with me. Those guys are doing gigs to tread water and buy crack, I guess. I wanted a whole life out of it. The roughest thing about those New York trips was that I lived like a grimy little roof rat, but I barely came out ahead. After a solid month back east, I would fly home to L.A., and I would only clear $500. The experience was valuable, but man, it was a lot of shit to eat for $500. 6 months after I was home, I'd realize I'd have to do it again. Running low on funds and scraping by. My two $28 spots at the L.A. Improv a week and zero movie parts weren't exactly paying the bills. One night I was hanging out in the hallway of the Improv on L.A.'s Melrose Avenue, dreading my flight the next day to depressing New York, and who walks by but Bud Friedman. Bud was the owner of the Improv and the biggest cheese at the club. He could make or break you, basically, of course. He could put you in showcases, give you great spots, or cut you out. Luckily, he was always very kind to me. I think he did actually think I was funny. He let me host at the Improv all the time, which, to be honest, was tedious because it meant I only got to do 5 minutes up front, and then I had to wait by the stage door to introduce every act for the rest of the night. But it was a gift just to be in the mix, to meet and see tons of great comics. I developed a sense of who I liked and who I didn't, and my style was sort of a research paper of all my favorites. Dennis Miller, Kevin Nealon, Steve Wright, among others, they became my subjects. I liked the subtle throwaway jokes, and I gravitated toward that style and kept it. That night, though, Bud stopped me in the hall and he goes, hello, David. Did you know we opened an improv in Las Vegas at the Riviera? I go, no, I did not. And he goes, do you want to play it this week? You'd have to leave tomorrow, but it's $500 for 7 days. Holy fuck! 500 is the magic number I clear after a month of shit gigs in crummy Jersey at BF Packy's with 35-year-old crackhead comics. Yes, of course I want to go to sunny, juicy Vegas that reminds me of Arizona. But I just nodded. Sure, man. Yeah, sounds cool. Let's do it. Even though I was totally stoked, but that hallway was too tight for cartwheels. $500. Here I come. I canceled my trip to New York and hopped in my car the next day heading for Las Wages. I mean Las Vegas. L-O-L-O-L-O-L-O-L-O-L. It's a bleak drive, but I didn't care. I was playing the strip. It's a 6-hour drive through the desert, and you pass the strangest things along the way. There's not much happening on that stretch of highway except a clump of fast food places every 50 miles and maybe a random 99-cent store in case you need some yarn or thumbtacks. So I get to my exciting Riviera gig. It's summer, so I was frying, but I didn't give a fuck. I'm a tough dude from the mean streets of Scottsdale, Arizona. I found out I was opening for Jackie Vernon, who is sort of a comedy legend. If not a legend, at least he's very well known. This was the status I'm shooting for. Legend seemed a little bit out of reach. Just well-known would be great. My name was on the marquee. A smarter kid would have taken a picture, but I didn't. So I can't show you. It's not like today where I would have 30 pictures of my walk to the marquee and a Snapchat of me staring at it and narrating. The deal at the Improv was that everyone did a short set. On a regular road gig, let's say Dallas Improv, there's a MC opener. He opens the show and does about 10 minutes. Then a middle act or a feature act, they call it, goes on and does 30. Then the headliner does 45 to an hour. At the Riviera Improv, it was scaled down. I was the MC, so I did 6 minutes up front. Then I bring another guy to do 8, and another better guy does 12, and the headliner does 25. And we did this show 3 times a night. That's 21 shows a week, folks. It was sort of brutal because as the MC, I had to be around for everything again. I couldn't really drift off because I might miss bringing up the next guy. It was fucking tedious, but way better than my little blue suitcase and guys pushing 37 in New York. I hung backstage with Steve Sciarippa, who was the doorman at the Riv. He's the big Italian guy who later went on to star in The Sopranos as Bobby. He was such a classic Vegas goomba. He told me when I got there to be on time, not to fuck around and keep my sets tight. One night I drifted off in the casino, classic, during someone's set, and I came back 1 minute late. 1 minute, folks! So the 8-minute guy had to bring on the 12-minute guy. Oh, boo-hoo. I didn't think it was a big deal, but Sciarippa was pissed. He told me to leave. I had to go back to my room and think about what I did, like I was a kid. So stupid. I'm like, so who cares? I'll just bring up the headliner. No, you fucked up. You get out of here. What a walk of shame back to my room that was. To add insult to inge, the comics didn't even get to stay at the Rib. We had to stay at some shithouse La Chonka Conca or whatever. Some oddly named ghetto motel next door, right behind the pepper mill. There were only 6 floors in it, and each floor had its own color. It was so old. Like, every room on every floor was a color. I stayed on red the first time. I got gold the second time. It was so weird. Anyway, I slinked back to my dumb red room, and I was scared shitless. Steve was going to rap me out to Bud, and I'd get fired. My whole life, I'm worried about getting fired. I was worried about it during all my busboy and dishwasher jobs. I did get fired from those. I was always stressed at road gigs when I wasn't killing, which I got fired for that, and always felt the heat during my first 5 years of SNL. Just always, always, always. No relation to Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. No wonder my neck is tight. But mostly during the Vegas week, I was in heaven. One day I snuck over to do some tanning. I know it's girly, but I admit it. At the Riviera pool. I grabbed a towel and a chair and cranked my Walkman. That was the only rich thing I had. I would hold up for the ladies to see and get horny about. Walkman over here, gals. Oh, yeah. For food, I was obviously on a snug budget, but luckily the Improv gave me 21 coupons for 21 meals at the Riviera Employee Cafeteria that week. It was a dump, but I was always in there. The only bummer is that my dates didn't see the charm in the place. I'd say, keep quiet and ask Hector the bellman if you can finish his omelet. On a side note, the comic I worked with the first time at the Riviera had weird hair. Now, I know I have weird hair, but this was different. We all thought it was clearly a toupee, but he was like 28 and had long brown hair, so we weren't sure. Because that didn't look like a toupee we'd seen before. But then on Wednesday, he came to the show with short hair. He casually mentioned he got a haircut, so the wig rumors dissipated. Until years later, when I found out this was his trick. He had two toupees, one long and one short. He would switch it every week on Wednesday and say he got a haircut. What a great move. Genius. I had mad respect for this fucking scam. I was fully hoodwinked. It was hard not to hit the casino and blow all my piddly earnings, by the way, I have to admit. You have so much free time on the road, and besides that, to get to the improv stage, I had to walk through the whole casino, which was so tempting. Slots, roulette, blackjack, chang, 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 even baccarat, which I still don't understand. They were 5 feet away from me at all times. Every day was a lesson in restraint. Ching, 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 ching. We have a winner. Wheel of Fortune. Boop, 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 boop. I always wanted to play. The showroom, by the way, was right next to Foxy Boxing, which was also tempting. Never nailed a Foxy Boxer. Still mad about it. When the week was over, the Riv asked me if I wanted to be paid in chips. Are you kidding me? Do I look like a moron? I took that check and I hightailed it out, thinking this was the easiest 500 I ever made in a long time. I hung on to that fucking check for dear life all the way back home to L.A.